just have a report from our correspondent, Dan, rather in Dallas, that he has confirmed that President Kennedy is dead. There is still no official confirmation of this, however. It's a report from our correspondent, Dan Rather, in Dallas, Texas.
The assassination of President John F. Kennedy was one of a string of trials and tribulations that occurred in a stormy period, covered and in part defined by CBS Evening News anchor Walter Cronkite. Some of us grew old listening to him. Some of us grew up listening to him. Some of us know his voice only from the sound clips of history from the 1960s and 70s, the heyday when he was known as the most trusted man in America. But few had a sense of the man before he became the face of network news, that is, until now. In a new book, The Personal Letters of Young Cronkite as a World War II correspondent to his wife, Betsy, during a three-year separation, have been compiled to tell us that story. The name of the book is Cronkite's War, his World War II letters home. Author Walter Cronkite IV, Capitol Hill Associate Producer for CBS News, is with us today from Washington, D.C. to talk about it. Welcome to the show, Walt.
Good morning.
Walt attended Hamilton College in Clinton, New York, where he studied history and writing under co-author Morris Isserman. Also with us is co-author Morris Isserman. He's written numerous books, including Fallen Giants, A History of Himalayan Mountaineering, and is currently at work on A History of American Mountaineering. Welcome, Morris, to the show.
Thank you, Ram.
First of all, the book covers letters that Walter Cronkite sent his wife, Betsy, not the other way around. And I have to admit that I yearned a bit for her responses and for the prompts to some of his letters. Do you know, Walt, what happened to that half of the equation?
Well, unfortunately, he was traveling a lot, reporting on World War II, and she was able to save all his letters home because she was at home. But he was traveling throughout the war, and he wasn't able to save all those letters that she wrote to him.
Did you know that that cache of letters existed?
I had no idea. And they were apparently up in boxes in their home. And he donated all of his papers to the University of Texas. And then after he died, my father and I went down to the University of Texas to explore those letters, to explore all of his papers. And we discovered these letters, and we thought it was just terrific and fascinating.
What did you learn? Did you just get confirmation of things you learned, or were there epiphanies? Was there something new in them that you didn't know?
Well, it was a confirmation of my grandparents' incredible marriage. I mean, I knew them when they were old, and they were married for almost 65 years. But seeing them as young newlyweds was pretty incredible. They were so dedicated to each other. He wrote my grandmother home several times a week. And he clearly missed her so much and yearned to be with her. But at the same time, this was one of the greatest events in human history, and he wanted to be in the front lines reporting it. So it was a tough separation for them.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the new book. It's called Cronkite's War, His World War II Letters Home. My guests, Walter Cronkite IV, grandson of Walter Cronkite, co-author with Morris Isserman. He's a historian and author himself and co-author of Cronkite's War. Morris, how do you know when a cache of letters like this can make a book?
Well, the letters unfold almost like a novel because you have these dramatic characters, Walter, Betsy, their love. You have the community of correspondents in London that Walter is becoming a part of. And you have these very dramatic events. He flies in the bomber over Germany in only the second American raid on Germany. He lands behind German lines in a glider in Operation Market Garden in 1944. His flat in London is hit by a V1 buzz bomb. It's a novel. It's a movie. It just leapt out at us as a story that needed to be told.
Tell us about Betsy Cronkite a bit, Walt. How did they meet? What did she do when in his absence?
They met in Kansas City. They're two Midwesterners, both from Kansas City originally. And my grandfather then moved to Texas when he was a young child, but then moved back to Kansas City to be with his grandparents after leaving University of Texas in the 1930s. And they were both working in radio, and they were doing a cosmetics advertisement. They were both voicing a cosmetics advertisement, and that's how they met. And they were married a few years later in the late 1930s, and they had this incredible marriage for the next 65 years. They were both very witty, funny people. They had a great rapport with each other, even when I was growing up and I knew them. There would always be cracking jokes, and my grandmother would make fun of my grandfather, kind of to pop his television-sized ego occasionally. And, like, for example, when my grandfather was losing his hearing when he was old, my grandmother would constantly make fun of that, the delight of all the grandchildren, by mouthing words at him, so he would think his hearing aid was broken. And so she was a prankster. She'd always be doing pranks. And they were fun people and fun to be around. They were always out and going to dinner and having interesting people to their house and keeping moving and sailing. And they were fun people to be around, and they clearly loved each other very much.
What did she do when he was away?
She worked for Hallmark Cards in Kansas City, and where she wrote some of the cards. So she was a writer herself. She actually went to the University of Missouri Journalism School and wrote for Hallmark Cards and wrote an advice column to the Lovelorn in one of the local papers there. So she was a journalist as well.
We have his letters to her because she saved them. Were there other letters? Was there other correspondence that he kept as regular as he did with Betsy?
There was a few letters to his mother, and we have a few more of his letters to his mother from when he was at the University of Texas. And then there's some letters from his time home when he was the bureau chief of Moscow, the United Press. My grandfather started out his career at the United Press before moving to CBS in the early 1950s.
Morris Isserman, how did you call them? What made the cut? Because I know there had to be a lot more letters than just what's in the book.
Right. There were over 100 letters. I think we have some or all of about 75 in there. Some of the letters were repetitive. Some of the letters were, you know, please send me some fruit juice. Please send me a new jacket, things he couldn't get in England. He hated the food in England. He kept longing for an American steak, and he hated the fact that the British served Brussels sprouts with everything. And, you know, the first time he complained about it, it was interesting. About the third or fourth time, we said, well, we can, you know, make a cut there. But what we wanted to keep was the personality that came through. You mentioned before that a lot of people grew up with Walter Cronkite, mm-hmm. and I was one of them. I watched him report on the Kennedy assassination and every major story down to Ronald Reagan's inauguration in 1981. And to me, he was in my generation, he was Uncle Walter. He was almost a member of the family. I didn't know him, but he was this kind of authoritative, mature voice of the news. And to see him as a very young man, very much in love with his wife, a punster, he would write naughty limericks to her, which I won't repeat on the radio. It was just a whole other way of viewing him, and it made him a real person, not just someone who appeared on the television screen every night.
Was it pretty typical back then for writers like him to make their way to television? I know that Edward Murrow wanted him to join his radio show.
Right. I mean, he was tempted. And he did do some broadcasts for CBS Radio from London, but his employer remained United Press. He turned that offer into a raise from United Press. And he thought of his career as a print journalist, and it was only on returning to the United States after his Moscow stint that he got involved first with radio, not CBS, but another radio consortium, and then CBS. And he was preparing to go to Korea as a war correspondent at the start of the Korean War, when he was invited to come down to this new broadcast, television broadcast, CBS News, out of Washington. And he gave a little chalk talk on a blackboard about what was happening in the Korean War. And his bosses noticed something about his appeal before the camera. And, of course, the rest is history.
You mentioned briefly when he was sent to London in the winter of 1943, he found himself a celebrity pretty quickly because of his coverage of the air offensive by the U.S. 8th Air Force against Nazi Germany. Weren't others covering this? What distinguished Walter Cronkite right off the bat, Morris?
Well, one of the things is that he was on this with this first group of correspondents who flew over Germany, and it was a very dangerous mission. And one of the bombers carrying the New York Times correspondent, Bob Post, was shot down, and all were lost. So the New York Times took the United Press wire service story, because they didn't have a report from their own correspondent, and planted it on the front page of the Times. Cronkite had a very dramatic writing style. I mean, he opens this dispatch on the bombing mission saying, "I've just come back from an assignment to hell," and he conveys that in the 500 words that follows. So he was just a very effective, direct journalist. He could really communicate a story. He was a hard-driving figure. You know, he was out for the scoop. He wanted to scoop his colleagues in London. He was very ambitious, and that's something else that's interesting to learn from this. He was torn by being separated from Betsy. He kept trying to figure out a way to bring her over to London to work as a reporter herself. He could never pull it off. But he was also delighted to be there. He was a young reporter with the biggest story of his lifetime, and he was going to make the most of it.
Walt Cronkite, how old was your grandpa when he was there?
He was 26 when he first went over. And one other thing about his reporting style, which was fast. He would make sure that he would try to be the first one back, and he was a very fast writer. Even though his dispatches were expertly written, they were also written very quickly. And throughout his career, he would pride himself and tell younger reporters about how quickly he could write. That was an important skill for the United Press and the wire service reporters to have.
He referred or described often, weaved it into his letters, that went back to the office, wrote three stories, went out drinking all night, just kind of liked to itemize his days in that way. It was pretty typical. He would sort of start with the morning getting up. But, of course, it was so much more interesting because he was in London during the Blitz. So,
and with all these fascinating people, he was from Kansas and Texas. And all of a sudden, he's thrown into the midst of all these interesting people, his fellow reporters, people like A.J. Liebling of The New Yorker, Bob Post of The New York Times. You see him in his letters writing home about covering Clark Gable, developing a good relationship with him, the famous actor, star of Gone with the Wind, and Jock Whitney, who's a financier from in that era. And all these interesting people. He had Christmas dinner of 1944 with Ernest Hemingway and his wife, Martha Gellhorn. So he's with the most interesting people in the world in London at this time of great cataclysmic events.
My guests, Walter Cronkite IV. He's a Capitol Hill associate producer for CBS News, grandson of Walter Cronkite, and co-author of a new book. It's called Cronkite's War: His World War II Letters Home. My other guest, Morris Isserman. He's a professor of history at Hamilton College and co-author of Cronkite's War. If you have a question, comment for either of the guests, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you could check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
New York City launched a bike share program this past weekend. It's supposed to boost local commerce, but will it really?
They had to park a block away or someplace where they could park to bring deliveries there. They complain because there's no parking.
I'm Sarah Gardner. The bumps in the road for the Big Apple's big bike share. Next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Pre-K. Program support is provided by the Arts and College Prep Academy. ACPA is now enrolling high school students looking for a safe and vigorous learning environment for all. More information about ACPA can be found online at artcollegeprep.org.
The WOSU Member Card Benefit of the Month for May is the Gateway Film Center. Enjoy 2-for-1 admission all month long. Visit WOSU.org.
Welcome back. We're talking about a new book. It's called Cronkite's War, his World War II letters home. And of course, it's about Walter Cronkite and co-authors Walter Cronkite IV and Morris Isserman. If you have a question or comment for them, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Walt Cronkite, did you grow up hearing stories about his work during the war? Did he talk about that a lot?
Yes, he did. In fact, those were his favorite stories. World War II was one of the defining moments of his life, and he loved talking about World War II. He would tell some of these same stories you read in the book. Some of them were actually slightly different. After 65 years of telling them and retelling them,
Sure. Some
things changed a little bit. But these were the stories that he loved to tell. These were his favorite stories around the dinner table, talking about Battle of the Bulge, General Patton, crash landing in a glider behind enemy lines at Arnhem during Operation Market Garden, and then the 12 days behind enemy lines, heavy shelling and bombing after that.
So how amazing that must have been then to discover the letters and go through them and kind of hear his voice in them.
Completely amazing. And such an experience. It was my father and I who discovered it together, and just going through it was very, very interesting. And then I went back down there with Professor Isserman, the renowned historian, and going through them again and getting more of the historical context, talking about the Eighth Army and the devastating losses they incurred every bombing raid they went on. They lost many people, and seeing it through my grandfather's eyes was quite an experience.
How accurate was he, Morris Isserman? Did he really toe the line when it came to the facts and the figures and what was really going on in his letters to Betsy?
Oh, yeah. The journalists who covered World War II were in no sense adversarial journalists. Mm-hmm. I mean, they thought of themselves as part of the team. They didn't want to undermine morale at home, but they wanted to convey the reality of the war. And so he would write about individuals. That was they would always do what they called hometowners. They would interview the navigator or the bombardier, and they'd say he's from Kansas City or he's from San Francisco or whatever. And sometimes he would write about the ones who didn't come back, or the ones who came back but were so badly shot up that they didn't survive. So he wanted to give a positive spin to the war, but he also wanted to convey some of the genuine costs of that war. His favorite dispatch of all was not the time he flew over Germany, but the time he was waiting at the air base, Molesworth Air Base in Cambridgeshire, and a B-17 came in piloted by a pilot he knew well, and who didn't make it, and he entitled it Nine Crying Boys because mm-hmm. all the rest of the crewmen were in tears about losing their pilot. So the writing is very dramatic. It's very heartfelt, but it's also very accurate.
I read a wonderful book, Citizens of London, by Lynn Olson, and it told a kind of not a different story in the sense of a more accurate or otherwise, but it told it from a different point of view, from the point of view of Edward R. Murrow and the ambassador to England and Averell Harriman and those kind of people. This was so detailed, and it told you what someone who wasn't making a lot of money, how they're kind of scratching their way through an existence in a very difficult place to live.
Yeah, Betsy had never been to Europe. He had never been to Europe. And so the letters are almost like a travelogue.
Yeah.
I mean, he literally says, I took you know, our nephew showed up, and I took him on the town. And here's what we did. We walked to the Houses of Parliament. We walked to Westminster Abbey. He's creating this word picture of London, which is sort of a tourist London, but it's also a wartime London, because we walk past the ruins of this or that street. And then when he gets to the continent, he does the same thing for Paris, to the Champs-Élysées, and saw the Eiffel Tower. And he's sharing the war with her and sharing this marvelous experience for this young man from the Midwest, seeing the wide world.
Any revelations, Walt Cronkite, when you read the letters, anything that surprised you?
His competitive spirit, which I had, something I had already known, but the extent of it, it was good to read how competitive he was, how important it was for him to get the story first, get it right, but get it first. He was always interested in scooping the competition. And you see that here. You see his career being made by him being fast, by him writing well. And as a young journalist myself, I'm learning by reading these letters. I'm learning how to work with the importance of having a great relationship with your colleagues, being able to share stories, share information, but also the importance of getting scooped.
Yeah, I never got the sense that he was underhanded in any way.
No, not at all. I think he was able to earn the respect of his colleagues and develop a close relationship with them. And these relationships lasted many years after the war as well. But he also, without being underhanded, he also got the story first and made sure that his story, the United Press story, got play in the newspapers back home. Not the Associated Press story. Big rival, Glad Hill.
Right.
Glad Hill of the Associated Press.
Was he famous back in the United States? Were people famous as journalists? I don't know how often that happens anymore as print journalists. You know, he got his name on the front page of the New York Times for his coverage of that particular offensive by the U.S. 8th, but... As a rule, was he well known?
He became part of a story. He was by late 1943. He was being referred to as the dean of the air war coverage.
Okay.
There were feature stories about him in Look magazine, and there was a radio program where an actor from New York portrayed Walter Cronkite reporting on some mythical air raid. A lot of these correspondents became famous during the war, like Ernie Pyle,
mm-hmm.
Edward R. Murrow, Harrison Salisbury, and others. And Cronkite was among them. It made his career.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the book Cronkite's War, His World War II Letters Home. My guests are Walter Cronkite IV, his grandson, and also Morris Isserman, professor of history at Hamilton College, both of them co-authors of the book. If you have a question or comment for them, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Do you remember reading Walter Cronkite's stories from World War from England, from France? Give us a call and tell us about it. 614-292-8513. A lot of his time was spent at a desk, but some of his assignments, including the air raid on Germany in January of 43, were very, very dangerous. What were some of the other risky assignments that he went out on? Walter Morrison?
Well, he traveled in convoys to and from Europe at the beginning of the war, and those were very dangerous at the time. So these were, the Atlantic waters were filled with Nazi U-boats, and convoys were dangerous. And he was in the North African campaign briefly, which was a dangerous assignment as well. He also, during D-Day, he flew in a bombing raid over Normandy. Unfortunately, the way he told it, there's a cloud cover, and he couldn't see anything below.
Mm-hmm.
He was disappointed about that throughout the rest of his life. He missed seeing the huge armada getting ready to invade Normandy. The Battle of the Bulge was a dangerous time for him as well. He wrote home to his wife Betsy, my grandmother, after the Battle of Arnhem, when he was behind enemy lines for 12 days. saying I was very, very scared, and I never want to do this again. I never want to see any more combat. I've seen enough. But then after that, he still saw more combat throughout the war. So he was definitely in the thick of things. And he would wait with the other correspondents at the base to see the 8th Army planes come back. So he was there waiting to see he saw the soldiers being carried out, wounded. So it was a very active experience for him.
He was scared. He said he didn't want to do it again, but he did. He didn't take it lightly. There was a seriousness about it. It wasn't thrill-seeking.
No, not at all. He worked his way up the newspaper business. He started as a newspaper boy, selling newspapers on the street. Throughout his high school and college, he worked for newspapers. He was very much an old-school print wire service reporter. He always looked up to Murrow, but unlike Edward R. Murrow, who you just mentioned, mm-hmm. he rose through the ranks of newspapers, and he was a firm believer in that old-school newspaper mentality.
Morris Isserman, can you talk a bit about the censorship of the time and how censorship worked during World War II with the American journalists?
Well, every news dispatch had to go through military censors so that he was often very circumscribed in what he could say. For example, when they flew over the Pas-de-Calais region of France in February 1944, he was on a bombing mission, and he could say that they were bombing secret German installations, but he couldn't say what they were. And in fact, they were the installations that were being put in to launch the V-1 buzz bomb rocket assaults on London. And his letters were censored, too, and he was very conscious of that. And he would sometimes say, I can't tell you what I've been doing or where I've been. He also devised a little code, which we figured out, to give Betsy a little more information, like he was able to signal to her that he was preparing to go on a glider assault on Europe by referring to a particular individual who was a glider pilot. He didn't say that, but Betsy knew that from a previous letter. So censorship was certainly part of the story.
He talked about holding on to a story. I can't remember which. It might have been that air offensive story, the first one, but he had to keep hold on to it and run it by the general. Or no, maybe it was an interview with the general, and they would run
right.
things by that to make sure it was accurate.
Right, and that involved a new technique using radar to guide the planes
okay.
over German cities so they could bomb even through the heavy cloud cover that often covered the continent.
So the censorship was two ways. Sometimes it frustrated them, but they pretty much went along with it.
Well, they had no choice. I mean, but also, again, they very much thought of themselves as part of the team. And mm-hmm. if it was going to help the war effort, they were going to do it. And if it was going to detract from the war effort, then even if there hadn't been official censorship, there would have been a form of voluntary censorship.
The collection covers 3 years of his life and his career. Walt Cronkite, did you notice that his writing improved over time in that way, or did it change in any way?
I think you certainly saw improvement in his writing. And there's a period where you see him write home to his wife that he was going to work on a wartime novel. And briefly, his letters become very literary and a little too literary. Morris and I were laughing about it when we were first reading it, that for a few weeks, his letters totally changed his style while he was working on his novel. Apparently, that novel got put aside, lost time, and never completed. And his letters went back to his more usual, non-literary, straightforward style. But you see him working actively in his writing throughout the book.
And started to go into sometimes I don't like to use the word shorthand, but more cryptic, just to save time and energy, it seemed like.
Yes.
Well, wire service reporters use something called cablese to shorten words and omit unnecessary words, because then the cables being sent across the Atlantic to New York would be rewritten. So you find little examples of that in the letters to Betsy, where instead of saying Czechoslovakia, he writes Czecho, et cetera, something like that.
Did he ever complain about not getting enough letters from her? Because sometimes he apologized that it had been a long time since he had been able to write her. And sometimes he said, it seems like everybody else is getting a letter today but me. I was wondering about that.
Well, his mood certainly improved when he got a letter, and delivery was uncertain.
Yeah.
And sometimes he'd get three or four letters all in a clump and a box of goodies, and sometimes he wouldn't hear. And we don't know. He may have written hundreds of more letters that Betsy didn't get or that got lost. We're just glad that we have the solid selection of 100 or so that did survive.
Did they talk, Walt, about their letter writing and how they corresponded during the war?
No, never. I had no idea these letters existed. They talked about how hard it was to be separated from the war.
Uh-huh.
And he always traveled and was away a lot throughout his career at CBS and as anchorman. But that made the fact that they were separated for 2.5 years during World War II made a separation of a month or a few weeks at a time seem like nothing. So I think it helped lay the groundwork for their successful marriage later on.
Yeah, 2.5 years after he went there, they did get together for a couple weeks in the United States before he had to go back again.
Yep.
Is that it?
Yes.
Why couldn't he get Betsy over there with him? Some of the reporters were able to get their wives over there.
You see him actively working on it. He was trying to get her accredited as a correspondent, too. You see Hemingway got his wife Gellhorn over there, but mm-hmm. he was of a much greater stature at the time than my grandfather. He had the pull. So I guess you see my grandfather kind of rising through the ranks in this book. But when he first went over there, he didn't have the pull or the influence that some of the other reporters had.
He eventually became a bureau chief. He asked Betsy to send him some better clothes, or he had to start upgrading his appearance and that kind of a thing. What did he end up doing that required, you know, more prestigious surroundings, more nicer clothes?
Well, for one thing, he kept losing weight. He lost 40 pounds. We have photographs from the family scrapbooks, and in 1942, he's got a kind of chubby face, and by 1945, when he comes back, he's as lean as a pencil, and his clothes are kind of hanging off his shoulders. But he was going to become the bureau chief for United Press, which is a very prestigious position in Brussels. That was his first post-war assignment, and so he felt he needed to actually get some clothes that fit him for that job.
My guests, Walter Cronkite IV, grandson of Walter Cronkite and co-author of a new book with Morris Isserman, my other guest. The name of the book is called Cronkite's War, His World War II Letters Home. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to our Facebook page and post your questions or comments there. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On Fresh Air, you'll hear conversations with entertaining people like Nancy Cartwright, the voice of Bart Simpson.
I gave him one take, one sound, one voice, and that was it.
Blah, 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 blah.
And Matt, his eyebrows went up, his tongue came out of his mouth. He's like, oh, my God, that's him, that's Bart, that's him. You got the part.
The most interesting people in show business tell their stories on Fresh Air.
Weekdays at noon on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from Grater's Ice Cream. For over 140 years, the Grater family has handmade ice cream in small batches using natural ingredients. Grater's new black cherry chocolate chip ice cream and other signature flavors are available at 10 neighborhood locations and grocery stores. More information at Grater's.com.
Thursday night, WOSU-TV takes you across the country on North America's most spectacular railways. More than just a tour, Trains Around North America traces railroad history. The show recounts the unforgettable stories of the continent's historic and scenic tourist railroads. From quiet and relaxing trains featuring spectacular meals and views, to fast-paced trains full of glitz and glamour. All aboard for Trains Around North America, Thursday night at 8 on WOSU-TV. This is 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, bringing you local and national news 24/7 and always streaming at WOSU.org.
This is my last broadcast as the anchorman of the CBS Evening News. For me, it's a moment for which I long have planned, but which nevertheless comes with some sadness. For almost two decades, after all, we've been meeting like this in the evenings, and I'll miss that.
So ended the career of Walter Cronkite as anchorman of the CBS Evening News. This hour we've been discussing his life before he became a venerated newsman, when he was young and just starting out covering World War II. A new book collects the letters of Walter Cronkite's time during World War II, and we're talking about that right now. It's called Cronkite's War, His World War II Letters Home, with Walter Cronkite IV and also Morris Isserman. If you have any questions or comments, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. He often referred to Judy in his letters, and at first I wasn't sure who she was. I don't know if I was reading too fast, but she turned out to be their Cocker Spaniel. And he asks and talks about Judy a lot. Walter? Walt?
He loved his dog, and he was kind of, it was almost strange. We ended up editing out some of the many times he talked about Judy. It got practically weird. I guess it was something he kind of held on to from back home, but he must have thought about her constantly, because he writes in all these letters very, very much about Judy, seeing a similar Cocker Spaniel on the train and talking to his owner about Judy. And so this must have been an important wartime memory that he held on to.
Well, that story about meeting a dog on a train ended very poignantly, too, because when the owner of that dog got up to leave, she said, "Come on, Judy, let's go."
Yep.
Right.
That was weird.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I think Judy was very much the Cronkite surrogate child. And, of course, because they were separated for 28 months, they were a young married couple, they weren't going to have any children. In fact, they didn't have their first child until he was bureau chief in Moscow at the 48. End of the 40s.
So Judy was a big deal. I was glad to see pictures of Judy in the book. Did you find any of these letters changing the way you saw your grandfather, Walt?
You know, I really didn't. Bob Schieffer, the CBS anchorman, said at his funeral that the beauty of Walter Cronkite was he was the exact same person on screen that he was off screen. And you saw that in these letters, too. He was the exact same person I knew growing up when he was an old man, that he was when he was a young man. Ambitious, smart, funny, caring, kind. This is the same person you see in the letters that I knew. And that was one of my biggest takeaways. And it was something that made me very happy to see that.
Yeah, I grew up watching him, listening to him, as Morris, you mentioned, you did too. What's it been like going through this correspondence from your point of view?
Well, I'm struck by his integrity as a journalist and as a man. There was a lot of bad behavior going on in journalist circles in London. I mean, these are mostly men, many of them married men. Harrison Salisbury, who was bureau chief for the London United Press and so was Cronkite's boss, in his own memoir writes very frankly about the kind of sex was in the air in London, and he winds up divorcing his wife, who's back in the United States during the war. And it's pretty clear by the constant efforts that Walter Cronkite is making to bring Betsy over that there's no hanky-panky involved there. He was devoted to this woman, and he wanted to be reunited with her. There's also, as you mentioned before, lots of drinking going on, and this was a heavy drinking generation, and journalists are a heavy drinking bunch and at all times. And Cronkite was always writing back to his wife and saying, well, everybody else is about, you know, two or three drinks ahead of me. And not that he was not partaking, but he didn't seem to be quite the consumer that one of his flatmates, Jim McGlinsey, fell into alcoholism over there. So he was, you know, he was a man and he was abroad and it was wartime. But he, you know, he stayed true to Betsy and he stayed true to himself.
Yeah, he wrote a lot about the drinking and often mentioned, and I that, but for me, I was okay. I could walk. I didn't stay for that last drink. And I guess that's one of the reasons why I'm always curious about what where Betsy came in at that point and said, you better not be, or something like that. Did finding and reading those letters, Morris Isserman, seeing them the way you did, affect your opinion of him?
Well, as Walt says, it reinforced what I already knew about mm-hmm. him. But, you know, there was another aspect to Cronkite's CBS career. He wasn't just the reporter. He also would anchor these documentary series. During the 1950s, there was a series called You Are There, which recreated historical moments
right.
in world history for everything from, you know, Joan of Arc's trial, but lots of World War II stories. There was a air war documentary, which he was uniquely qualified to be narrating. I think it was called Air Power, and it was about the air war during World War II. And then, most importantly, there was the series called The 20th Century, which began in the late 50s and ran into the late 60s or the 70s, and it would be once or twice a month, and it would be about important events in the 20th century, and often it was about World War II. And then finally, on the anniversary of D-Day, on the 20th anniversary, Cronkite, very extraordinary program, did a CBS special report traveling with President, former General Eisenhower, to the beaches of Normandy and to the American cemetery. And reading the World War II letters and thinking about all of these documentaries that I watched growing up, it made me think that Cronkite really helped shape, as much as any historian, probably more, our collective memory of World War II, of the Greatest Generation. He really, in a way, embodied that war time experience.
Walter Cronkite IV, your grandpa talked about it a lot. He talked about the war a lot. Did it feel like he was telling stories just to yuck it up and tell stories? How did it feel as a grandchild hearing these stories? Did you sense that what was coming, become part of his fiber?
Absolutely. This was the time that made him the man he was in many ways. I mean, it must have been a traumatic experience in many ways, so it shaped him in that way. We see it developed his career. It put him into the first ranks of American reporters. I think he also enjoyed telling the stories. I mean, these were tough times, but they were also great adventures for him and for the people he experienced it with. And I think these were the stories he really relished, and he got a kick out of telling these stories. And I think his young boys love hearing stories about mm-hmm. war and that sort of thing. And I'd watch the Patton movie, and then he would tell me his stories about General Patton or so on. And I think he definitely got a kick out of telling these stories.
Which of his stories stands out in your mind as the ones that made him back then as a reporter?
I think the Nine Yankees Crying story
mm-hmm.
that Morris Isserman just mentioned was very powerful. He was him waiting at the Air Force Base and seeing the bloody plane and the RAF compatriots knowing there's nothing they can say, and it's just a tough thing and there's nothing anyone can do. So I think that sense of empathy that he had was very powerful. I think it led him, his innate empathy that was unforced, unfaked. It related to people, and his relatability partially came from his empathy.
Sometimes it was shocking to read when he wrote about the bombings and how close he in London and how close he came to them. You know, one night or one day, just hiding under the covers and plugging his ears because they were so close. But and even as he described them, it sounded like he was trying to make them sound as ordinary as possible, too.
I think also he was playing down some of the danger. He was, he was writing letters home to his wife. And I think he didn't want her to worry. So I think throughout these letters, you see a sense of him trying to play down the risks he was taking.
Morris Esserman, did you, in putting this book together, look at other letters of other war correspondents of the time and see any parallels or divergences?
Well, I'm not familiar with any other collection of letters, but we certainly read the memoirs. Andy Rooney has a book called My War, and Andy Rooney grew very close to Cronkite during the war, and they were colleagues at CBS later on. Harrison Salisbury wrote about his experiences. I think for all of them, they felt that they had this tremendous opportunity. They were thrust into this world historical situation and given the greatest story of their generation to cover as reporters. So they were all individuals, but they were all part of this community of reporters.
Mike in Clintonville, you're on the air. Welcome, Mike.
Hey, thank you. I just saw a documentary about the gliders during World War II, and I guess the Cronkites can confirm this, but Mr. Cronkite related a story of landing. I think it was during the invasion, the Normandy invasion, but the glider he was aboard crashed, which was typical of the gliders, but his helmet came off, and he grabbed the first helmet he could grabbed, not realizing he grabbed an officer's helmet because everybody's helmet apparently flew off. And so he had all these soldiers following him, thinking that he was the captain, and he was just a reporter. It was told, I think, with tongue in cheek, but it was entertaining, that's for sure. But anyways, that's my story. Thank you.
Do you remember that?
That was Operation Market Garden. Mm-hmm. So they were landing in Holland in September of 1944. And if you've seen the Band of Brothers episode where they land, they're talking with paratroopers, but there were also glider troops, and they march through Eindhoven. And that night, Eindhoven is bombed by the Germans, and Easy Company is outside looking at the bombing. Well, Cronkite was in the city and scurrying around trying to find shelter away from the German bombs. One of the things he was very proud of, the correspondents wore uniforms. He was granted the right to wear the 101st Airborne Screaming Eagle insignia as his shoulder patch on his correspondent's uniform because he'd made that glider landing.
Glenn in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, Glenn.
Hi, I'm not sure if my memory is correct, but I seem to recall something in a memoir about Walter witnessing a shooting in Texas where a black boy was shot for riding a bicycle across someone's lawn and there were no consequences. Whether that's true or not, did he write anything about race and racial issues during the war? When he was in Europe, did you see differences over there?
I don't remember him writing about any racial differences during the war. He was embedded with the 8th Air Force. His one story I remember him telling when I was growing up was when he first moved to Texas from Kansas City. His father was a dentist, and he met with his father's new colleague who invited them over to his house for ice cream. And the delivery man was African-American in the segregated Houston, Texas. And the delivery man walked up the front porch instead of walking behind the porch. And the owner of the house, my great-grandfather's new colleague, walked over and punched the poor delivery man in the face just out of nowhere, sucker punched him because he didn't take the back entrance. And my great-grandfather got up, took his wife and kids, and said, we're leaving. And he quit that practice and joined a different practice in Houston, Texas. That was something my grandfather was always very proud of.
Yeah, a terrorist state, in a sense.
Yeah.
We could be treated that way on an everyday basis.
Glenn, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Take care.
Did he, you said there was a lot of redundancies in a lot of his letters, so you cut him out. What were the things he liked to write about the most? What was he redundant about? It must have been important.
Food fantasies.
Okay.
Boy, if I was in Kansas City or if we were in New York, do you remember that restaurant we went to on West 72nd Street? There was a lot of that. Some of that's still in there.
Right. Some of it is, he doesn't talk about the food much, but he does talk about where you could get a good meal for 80 cents. But he never really goes on and on about how great the food was.
No, he does not like British cuisine. And he lost so much weight, we were thinking of titling the book the Walter Cronkite Wartime Austerity Diet Book, but decided against it.
Walt, how has the family enjoyed the book? What have they made of it?
Oh, yeah, everyone's thrilled, and everyone is, you know, it's great for everyone to see that these letters were just, you know, my family saw the letters before the book came out, and it's just pretty incredible, and it was nice to see the relationship between my grandparents.
And Morris Isserman, just as a parting comments, what do we learn about the war from Walter Cronkite through these letters? What do we learn?
Well, I think we learn about how the war was reported and how the reporters were torn between their professional responsibility to give the facts, and the facts about the 8th Air Force campaign was that it was extremely costly, but also there's this desire to be team players and not to undermine wartime morale. So they couldn't actually point out, you never find this in any of his reports, that only 1 in 4 air crew could expect to survive their 25 missions, which is what they were required to fly before they came home, without being either killed or wounded or captured. In 1943, 3/4 of the air crew in the 8th Air Force were lost one way or the other. It's an extraordinary story. And he could hint at that story, and he could talk about individuals being lost, but he could never give the full dimension of it.
Thank you so much, Morris Isserman, for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure.
And also, Walter Cronkite IV, thank you as well. We appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much.
Walter Cronkite IV and Morris Isserman, co-authors of Cronkite's War, His World War II Letters Home. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.